who died in South Sudan 2 years ago and was either caught in the crossfire or was targeted because he was a journalist, which is what we think happened. So it's happening in many different ways, but it doesn't matter how it happens. If we don't have journalists, we can't survive as a democratic society.
Thank you very much, Nancy. I could not agree with you more. But just to stay one more minute on Chelsea Manning, why has she been charged now with contempt of court? And what does this mean beyond her? You know, does this have implication for us? Should we be worried about her being charged with contempt of court?
Well, yes. Chelsea was originally given a sentence of 35 years, which was itself unconscionable. We arranged her clemency, the president gave her clemency, and so she only served 7 years, which was also too long. So she was out, and then she got a subpoena to appear before a grand jury, presumably to testify about this charge that you just heard about about Julian Assange. We don't know what the questions were. Grand juries are secret proceedings. She doesn't get to have a lawyer with her, whether she's a witness or a target, even a target of the grand jury. Even someone who's in front of the grand jury as a suspect does not get to have a lawyer with them in the federal system. It's a completely secret process. It's all weighted to the prosecution side, and there's no defense. Chelsea's position and the reason she is in jail is not just about Julian Assange. It's that she does not believe in the grand jury system and she's not willing to take part in it. So it's a principled position and a very strong and courageous one that she's simply not going to cooperate with a totally secret system that we shouldn't have in this country, and I agree with her. So she, as it's said in the law, she holds the keys to the jail. She can agree to testify and get out of jail, or she stays in jail. The judges also fined her for every day, I think in an effort, he thought, to keep her in. The grand jury lasts 18 months. The first grand jury, when she was arrested, was near the end of its term. So she served a few months, got out, and got another subpoena to come back in. So this one is 18 months. It could keep going. It could keep going forever. Eventually, the judge will have to rule that this is a punishment and that she's never going to testify and release her. And that's what we've seen happen in the past. But that's why she's in jail now. She's in a woman's facility. She's in Richmond, Virginia. She's in general population. You can write to her anytime you want. She receives letters, and we encourage people to write to her and show support for her. But that's why she's there, and she's going to be there, I suspect, for the whole 18 months, unless the Court of Appeals changes that.
Thank you, Nancy. Sandy, I thought as a last speaker, you could probably lift us to a global stage, because that's where you work, and I know that you've done this excellent overview of how whistleblowers are treated around the world. So I was hoping that you could do that for us tonight. You know, what's the state of play right now around the world as far as the whistleblowers are concerned, and how does the U.S. fit into that global framework?
Great. Well, I'll give an overview of whistleblowing internationally, and then also refer to an amicus brief that we put together in support of Chelsea Manning's appeal that compared her sentence to what she likely would have received in countries that we consider to be our democratic allies. So whistleblowing has quickly matured into a norm of international law and custom. The United States was the first country to pass a whistleblower protection law in 1970. That was strengthened in 1978 following the whole Watergate situation. But and then the next country to adopt a law was the United Kingdom in 1998, South Africa in 2003. So a pretty slow development over that 50-year period. Then whistleblowing became more common in the fight against corruption. So in 2003, actually, the United Nations adopted a convention against corruption, which has now been ratified by 137 countries, including the United States. And that commits the signatory states to provide protection for anti-corruption whistleblowers. Similarly, in the Council of Europe, there's a treaty that protects whistleblowers who disclose corruption, and that is defined as illegal activity of misuse of power or misuse of public funds. The Council of Europe, which is the body of 47 member states that spans the whole of Europe, started to address the situation of national security whistleblowing following the Snowden revelations of 2013. And the first body of the Council of Europe to address this was the Parliamentary Assembly, which is comprised of legislators from the 47 member states. In 2015, this Parliamentary Assembly issued a report finding that Edward Snowden was indeed a whistleblower and calling on member states to provide him asylum unless he was returned to a country where he could raise a public interest defense. And it was quite dramatic to be referencing the public interest defense because that has not been spelled out in a treaty and it's rarely been spelled out in statute. The only country that has a clear public interest defense for national security disclosure is Canada. The UK, the Official Secrets Act, is often thought to be one of the most draconian. In fact, it only provides a 2-year penalty for disclosure of classified information. And the 1989 law added that there's only a crime if the information disclosed damages the national interest. The Official Secrets Act cases are tried to juries, and that gives room for making the arguments that one would want to make on behalf of Assange and Manning. So the Council of Europe was looking at this public interest defense based primarily upon decisions of the European Court of Human Rights, which had elaborated that in certain circumstances, a person should not receive any penalty for disclosing information, even if classified, where the value of the disclosure outweighs the harm to national interests. And the factors that the European Court elaborated included some factors that the best practice would challenge. So it included that there had to be good motive, and that there had to be a belief in the veracity of the information, that there could be no alternative methods for disclosure. And that is a prong which is easily satisfied in many countries if it can be shown that reporting is only available by reporting to your own superiors and that there's a threat not only to yourself of employment discrimination, but also of destruction of evidence. So in 2015, this Parliamentary Assembly passed a resolution on whistleblowing, where it expressly said that a person in Snowden's situation should not be found to be a whistleblower if his disclosures was in compliance with the Council of Europe standards that have been previously articulated, or those set forth in the Schwanee principles on national security and the right to information. I brought this pamphlet along, and it's a side note is that this really demonstrates the power of citizens in making international law. These principles were developed by 22 organizations working together with UN rapporteurs on freedom of expression and on national security, and also regional special experts. Sitting down in meetings, often with security officials around the world, consulted about 500 people all over the world, including national security experts, former police, ministers of interior, and developed sufficient credibility that the Council of Europe was referencing this as the standard. The Schwanee principles not only set forth a public interest defense, but also say even if a person can't qualify for a public interest defense, criminal penalties for disclosure to the public should be available only in the narrowest of circumstances, and set forth four criteria. The first is that criminal penalties should apply only to the disclosure of narrow categories of information that are clearly set forth in law. So it can't be simply that something is marked as national security. Second, that disclosure should pose a real and identifiable risk of causing significant harm. Penalty as set forth in law and as applied should be proportional to the actual harm caused. And fourth, the person should be able to raise the public interest defense, as also outlined in these principles. So these standards are finding their way into case law in a few countries and are being referenced, especially when laws are being drafted. And what's interesting is that countries are not challenging the credibility of the drafters of these principles, or they're not challenging the source of these materials, because they are based upon international jurisprudence. They may argue about the ineffectiveness or about the challenges of having the vagueness of a standard like the public interest defense. I'll move on.
Sandy, how does the issue that we have raised so far in the United States, how does it compare to the international standard, and B, the international practice? Is the U.S. an outlier in its treatment of whistleblowers, or is it actually following global pattern?
Well, the use of the Espionage Act is definitely puts the U.S. as an outlier. In terms of the penalties for unauthorized disclosure, as strong as the statements of the Council of Europe have been, individual states have not had the opportunity so much to actually apply these laws, so we're not sure what would happen if there would be a similar kind of large-scale disclosure. But the closest case that I could find was from Israel. There was a case in 2000 of an army soldier who disclosed about 2,000 documents on a CD to the media. And these documents showed that the IDF had approved assassinations in the West Bank, even when it could have been possible to arrest the targets instead. And the top-ranking army officers authorized the killings in advance, in writing, even if innocent bystanders would be killed as well. This was quite a disclosure, not only because it suggests war crimes, but because the IDF had intentionally violated a 2006 decision of Israel's Supreme Court. The intelligence service said that this was these disclosures put Israeli troops at harm, and indeed put Israeli civilians at harm. And the Israeli soldier was indicted for aggravated espionage with intent to harm the security of the state, which carries a maximum penalty of life in prison. She confessed not to that crime, but to possession and transfer of classified documents and unauthorized transfer of secret information. She was sentenced to 4.5 years, and on appeal, the Supreme Court reduced her sentence to 3.5 years, recognizing that the documents could indeed have put civilians at risk, but nonetheless, she had admitted her guilt, she had cooperated with authorities, there was no prior offenses, and the information disclosed was of very high public interest. So a country at war, facing national security risks, a close ally, and 3.5 years for an offense that was agreed to put the state at greater harm. I just briefly to say that we surveyed about 30 countries to look for what the trends were. And in the 30 countries that are all democracies, 12 of those countries, penalties for unauthorized public disclosure of national security information are limited to 5 or fewer years. Unless the state proves that there's espionage, treason, delivery to a foreign country, or intent to prejudice the country's security or defense. So those 12 countries include the UK and Australia, which have a maximum of 2 years, New Zealand and Slovenia, 3 years, Panama and Spain, 4 years, Colombia and Norway, 4.5 years, Belgium, Mexico, Paraguay, and Poland, 5 years. And I'll end by just noting that there are some countries that have penalties of up to 10 years. And Canada, for instance, has a penalty of up to 14 years, but it has a public interest defense. And the other countries that have penalties of up to 10 years also have mitigation. So I would say, indeed, that the U.S. is quite an outlier.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Before I turn to the public, do you guys want to react to each other's maybe? Yes, Niels, go ahead.
I just want to follow up on your just the last example you brought with the Israeli case. How many of the officers that were involved in these operations of assassination have been prosecuted? Do you know?
I don't know. But we
because that's the elephant in the room in all these cases.
Okay, so there were a couple of questions in my back is here, so you want to, we're going to take a few questions.
Hi, I'm James Goodell. I was counsel at the time for the Pentagon Papers case. I would like to say that I thought the panel was terrific. I thought the articulation of the public interest standard was great. However, for me, and I'm quite sure I'm right about this, the Assange case is not a public interest case, it's a First Amendment case. And I would like to have heard from the panel what they thought about the application of the First Amendment to Assange. I think that it's quite clear that it is a First Amendment case. I don't want to bore the audience with all my reasoning. And I think that, secondly, when the government comes in and is met with the First Amendment defense, it's not a slam dunk for Assange. It's going to be a difficult, a not easy case for the government to prove that the disclosures in question constitute a clear and present danger to national security. They're going to have to show, in my view, because it's what they had to do in the Pentagon Papers case by case, why a particular disclosure violated that standard. I can go on for a long time, but I won't.
Thank you very much. Do you guys want to take these questions? It's a complex,
interesting question. So how are you going to find it? Thank you, Mr. Goodall. I totally agree that there's a strong First Amendment interest, a strong First Amendment case to be made on behalf of Assange under the current Espionage Act charges. There's a lot of debate, it seems, about what framework would apply under the First Amendment, whether or not under a narrow tailoring analysis you would apply the clear and present danger test, or you would engage in a balancing that incorporates consideration of the public interest versus the national security interest, something along the lines of what the court did in Bartnicki. And in the case of whistleblowers as to journalists, that would be, you know, slightly different framework, maybe under Pickering. But I think definitely the threat to freedom of the press under the Espionage Act as it's currently written and as it's been applied to Julian Assange in this case is clear. And there are other arguments you can make about the overbreadth of the statute, the fact that it's been selectively applied to individuals who release information that embarrasses the government or makes the government look bad, as opposed to numerous instances in which leaks have been made intentionally by the government to bolster the government's case in a particular situation. So while a number of different arguments have been made about the way that the First Amendment applies in a particular case under the Espionage Act, given that this is the first prosecution of a publisher of information of clear public concern, it seems as though the First Amendment should come into play and be a strong defense for Julian Assange.
Thank you, Carrie.
Hi. So what happens, let's say, with Chelsea Manning's case, that let's suppose what she did for argument's sake is in the public interest. Let's suppose that that should be a legal defense, and it becomes standard. My concern is what happens, who should decide if it's in the public interest to release classified information? What happens if you have thousands of potential whistleblowers saying, oh, okay, I'll release classified information, it's in the public interest. You mentioned Canada as an exception, they allow it in the public interest, but Canada, in terms of foreign policy, has had a history of neutrality, so I don't know if that would be the best example, but I'm interested in your response.
So a bit more challenge, which is good. We actually initially wanted to have an additional speaker here who would have taken maybe a more aggressive position regarding those cases. So how do you answer those who argue that these actually leaks are an actual threat to national security and so on?
I would have said a bad question.
Right. So I'm going to start with the easy question about Canada and then come back. So not to minimize Canada, Canada is one of the five eyes, along with the United States, the UK, New Zealand, and Australia. It has access to just about all intelligence information that the US has. So it's one of the US's closest allies, and it has access to certainly the information that Snowden had. Is it a question that I would ask is, you know, why haven't there been more disclosures? Why haven't the consciences of technologists in the Five Eyes been motivated to disclose? As far as the whole mechanism of whistleblowing as a check on government, it is not the institutional check, but it is a structural check. It is recognized in the way that the public interest defense is defined when there is not an internal process for disclosure which is effective and which yields to investigations of the wrongdoing that's being whistleblown. As Niels mentioned, this is probably the weakest point of most internal disclosure regimes. So the press has been entrusted with knowing what is news, knowing what's in the public interest, and using restraint not to disclose information that damages national security. It's been recognized as a fourth estate and as a necessary guard against tyranny. And Now the argument is that whistleblowers are a key part of that structure, that the journalists need their sources. And the whistleblower can, it goes to a media, the media may exercise its journalistic principles. But in any event, there is a check, because if the court or the jury find that the public interest does not outweigh the harm, then the whistleblower does suffer a penalty. And beyond that, I suppose one can say that the literature shows that whistleblowers always suffer a penalty. They always lose their careers. And whistleblowers, most whistleblowers now know that, to the extent that they ever get any advice, it's the last resort. The fact that there have been so few disclosures of the Snowden and Chelsea Manning type suggests just what a deterrent is already provided by the penalties.
Nancy, you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, kind of to very directly answer your question, how would it be decided whether somebody...
Who should decide?
Well, it'll be a court. It'll be a jury. It'll be evidence before the court. Was this in the public interest or wasn't it? Were these war crimes that were disclosed or weren't they? All the things that couldn't be raised, for example, in Chelsea's case. Was anyone damaged? Should it have been classified? What was the reason why the public needed to know? This could come out in a court, and as Sandra said, the jury would then decide. That's how it would work.
My concern with that is what the damage could already be done, and you can't do damage to national security. That would my concern.
Your concern is that when the documents were disclosed that national security had already been damaged?
And it can't be undone.
No, it can't be undone, but that's always
the public interest.
That's always the case. You know, if someone goes to trial for an alleged crime, the damage may have already been done. But there's no way out of that. We just have to make sure that the damage is not overstated.
Can I ask a question regarding the quantity of documents that is being released, and how does this impact on the arguments that you are making? Does it impact? Is it, it's one thing to release one, you know, couple of documents demonstrating war crimes. What if you release millions of documents? How does this impact on the nature of the case? And do you think this is one of the concerns behind the heavy-handed response?
Well, I'll start with the international perspective. Certainly, the public interest defense says that the disclosure should only be such as is necessary to disclose the wrongdoing. And so when whole troves of documents are disclosed, it's hard to make that argument. And in Chelsea Manning's case, it was probably hard to meet that defense because she may not have even read all of the documents that she was disclosing. There have been cases that have parsed the quantum. Looking at Snowden's revelations, you would say that there was a very high public interest in his disclosures about the secret surveillance. But he also disclosed information about particular surveillance operations in Pakistan and China. And one could, there would be arguments certainly made that there was no reason to disclose those documents. And then it is a weighing. Absolutely, these are new kinds of cases now where there's such a capacity to disclose such a great volume that certainly the U.S. Army wanted to send a message. And again, it's just very interesting that there haven't been more disclosures in more countries.
Yeah. Maybe we take several questions because I see quite a lot of people. So please.
Hi, thank you. Carrie Shankman, I'm a civil rights attorney. I've been working closely with many of these issues for years and deeply grateful to the panel comprised of many folks who I deeply respect. So I'm actually co-authoring a book on the Espionage Act. My co-author is here right now. And one of the points that came up in our research, and I think something to caution when I see happening often in the field and right now is the conflation of three distinct categories of potential defendants under the Espionage Act. And this is something that we see, we see in the press a lot. So there's classic spies, classic espionage, trying to provide assistance to a foreign government covertly. And second are government employees or individuals who have some sort of relationship with the government, who have signed an NDA or have some commitment to keep secrets. And then third are either members of the press, everyone else, the public. And I think, at least so far in this conversation, and a lot of the time in the press, we often see Julian Assange is a whistleblower, or the idea that all these folks get lumped together, when actually, and this I think is going to go off Mr. Goodell's point, is that these should be really the same categories of people. And that under the First Amendment, Julian Assange is indistinguishable from any person in this room. And I think that's really important to keep in mind in terms of the framework that we're creating, and I think it's one of the key problems of the Espionage Act, and that legally it creates a system where we're putting the same penalty, the same legal obligation, and the same lack of public interest defense, if you will, on all these categories. Because I actually would agree with the panel, and have been advocating for this for years, that we do need a public interest defense for whistleblowers. But I don't think we need a public interest defense for members of the media. If I'm charged under the Espionage Act for retweeting a New York Times story that contains classified information, I don't want to have the burden to come to court and prove that what I tweeted is in the public interest. There should be an absolute First Amendment defense to that activity. So, thanks.
Okay, let's take one more, or two more, and then we open up to the...
I was meant to hug the mic a little bit. My name is Paula Isellen. I'm from New Hampshire. I'm an online and on-the-ground activist for Team Assange, which also is Team Chelsea. I'm here with Laura. Ordinarily, we would be home live-tweeting this event, because that's what we do. We'd be taking screenshots of you, writing quotes, and getting it out into the media. But you're not an ocean away. Thank you for sponsoring this forum. Awesome. I came down, it's a yo-yo trip for me, 10 hours. I came down to see rock star Nils Melzer. When, honestly, I consider myself Team Assange, which I believe Christine Assange coined that phrase, including all of us, actively advocating for her son. When you came in and did your report, you didn't let it just die. You didn't just do the report. You marketed it. You came out on social media. You did every interview you could. You did. It was awesome. You were a shining light. So usually, I'm not an expert. I'm usually reporting and lifting the experts up. But I'd like to take a moment to speak as an activist. And I'm not a speaker, and I'm really, really nervous. So what I did, I looked at the online invite, and it said, does Julian Assange merit support and solidarity? I said, hell no. We're way beyond that. The question is, how do we stop the extradition, and how do we get him out of solitary confinement? That's the question. That's what we're fighting for. And as an activist, we know that's the point where we are, because he is rotting in the prison. When he gets up and speaks in court, he can barely put a sentence together. He's the most brilliant mind of our century. So I have something written, but honestly, I'm going to be brutally honest here, because this is about free speech. I saw Democracy Now! Here, and I don't have this written, so forgive me. This is my opinion. I didn't become active because I'm just a normal person looking for the truth and looking for media that's telling it. So my go-to source was Democracy Now. And I really didn't know what was going on with Julian. I just know that he told the truth, and he had a big following on Twitter, and he was on Democracy Now, and he had a platform. Well, he was reporting on Catalonia. He gave Catalonia a lot. He taught the activists there how to publicize it with their cell phones. And it was Julian that got it out. And Amy did an interview, one of the last interviews Julian ever did before he was gagged, and that's when I came on board. I came on board when he was gagged. March 21st, I believe, 2018. Because I said, hell, what happened? Now they're going to disappear him. It's not bad enough that he's in the embassy and, you know, for 6 years. So, forgive me, Amy, but this is my take on it. That last interview with Julian Assange, he was trying to talk about Catalonia, and you were trying to talk about Roger Stone. He got upset, and he said, Amy, because it was the Spanish government brutalizing the Catalonians trying to vote. And she kept coming back to Roger Stone, and he said, I am going to stop doing these interviews. And damn, if he wasn't gagged like 6 days later. So I kept coming back to Democracy Now, looking for, okay, they disappeared him. Who's going to stand up for him? And nobody was reporting on it. So this is where I'm going to pick up on what I wrote. And I'm sorry I'm taking so long, but activists never get on a panel. And so this is where I'm going to pick up. So I was responding to that little bit, that question about does he merit support, which is just makes me want to scream. And I don't know who wrote that on your invite, but that is just so insulting to Julian Assange. First of all, I want to give a shout out to all the shining stars in this movement. Neil Meltzer, awesome. Julian's parents, Christine Assange and John Shipton. John Shipton moved to London to advocate for his son. And if anybody wants to know Julian's personality, watch a John Shipton interview, because the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree. John Shipton couldn't be more of a gentleman, more witty, more everything Julian is. Watch a John Shipton interview, and he's doing a lot of them. So
what I propose is that because there are a lot of other speakers, will it be possible for you to give us what you've written, to send it to us so we put it on two or three of the website of the organizations? And let's take a few more questions, and if we have more time, we come back to you. Is that okay?
Well, no, I want to say what I want to say.
But you are taking a lot of time, and I think there are a few other people.
Let's see.
Okay. I don't know. Is there anyone else who wants to speak? Okay. Let's listen to a few more speakers, and then we'll go back to you.
Well, my name is Fred Mazzellis. I'm with the World Socialist website. I write for it. It's the leading, really the only international voice in defense of online of Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. And I agree with much of what the previous speaker has said, but I just want to center my remarks very briefly on what I think are, I think the panel quite understandably is focused to a great extent on legal and constitutional questions. It's their business, you know, and it's important. But there are very crucial political questions that have to be stressed. I think that Niels Meltzer explained briefly in the beginning when he said, you know, why has this happened? Because he exposed war crimes. And the question was not only changing the subject so that we were talking about Julian Assange and his cat instead of the war crimes, the question was also, as I think another speaker has pointed out, the deterrent effect of the attacks on Julian Assange. I think, Sandy Colliver pointed that out, but at the same time, you then wonder why others haven't come forward. Well, his freedom was taken away how many years ago? I mean, obviously, there is a method to this madness. And the point that I want to stress finally, and especially, on which most people in this room may not agree with me, we have to ask ourselves, why is it not a single major Democratic Party candidate has seen, and that includes Bernie Sanders, of course, has seen fit to come to the defense in this most crucial question of free speech and political prisoners? That's what we're dealing with. They talk about human rights elsewhere. How about at home, right here? And I think we have to answer that. What is the national interest? Whose national interest are we speaking of here? It's the national interest of American capitalism, not the national interest of the vast majority of the people in this country or elsewhere around the world. And as difficult as it might be, we have to turn to those forces to free Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. And that's what the World Socialist website is fighting for.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Why is nobody defending Julian Assange within the political establishment? No one wants to touch him, really. Within the elections, within the process of discussion. So why? Do you have any answer to that question? It's not just here, by the way. It's everywhere.
I think compared to a mobbing situation at school, no one wants to be friends with the mobbed kid because you're risking your own well-being. And that's what I see since I got into this case. And, luckily the special rapporteurs are not paid, so no one can basically fire me, and no one can kind of cut my salary, So basically, I'm starting at zero, and so I can, what I see is even when I talk to press or I try to get other people involved, it's very, very difficult because they're all afraid that this could contaminate, kids could contaminate them somehow and pull them down and harm them. And so I think the deterrent effect that was just mentioned is extremely important.
I hope I'm not misremembering this, but I do think Charlie Savage of the New York Times asked all of the major Democratic candidates what their position on the Assange indictment was, and I think he had each of them respond. So that might be one place to look.
Only on the
espionage act charges?
Yeah. And I wonder if I could ask Nancy a question about the process to get Obama to grant clemency to Chelsea Manning, and what motivated him, and why did he wait so long?
Well, I have no idea what motivated him, particularly except for what he said. I know what we did. We prepared the papers initially not thinking we had any chance, but why not? I mean, I've been in this business a long time, and I've been an activist my whole adult life, which is part of why I'm a lawyer. But we did it because it was a possibility, and you never know what will happen. Chelsea didn't meet any of the requirements that Obama had laid out for pardons or for clemency. She didn't meet any of the requirements from the Army. So we kind of made it up as we went along. The Army did require, because this was a military case, we had to go through the Army to get any kind of clemency or pardon. But they did require letters from character witnesses, one of whom had to have been someone who had met Chelsea. So I asked Glenn Greenwald to write that, and he did. And I asked Daniel Ellsberg to write one, and he did. And I asked Colonel Morris Davis, the former chief prosecutor in Guantanamo, to write one. He had testified in Chelsea's case in the defense, for the defense, that what she disclosed of the Guantanamo Task Force documents were not harmful in any way and were basically irrelevant documents. And he wrote one, and I think those were really important. There was also a petition. I think 100,000 people from the ACLU started this petition. And then the president did it. It was a surprise to all of us, but a wonderful surprise, and of course the right thing to do. But what he said, which is all we can go on really, is that her sentence was too long in relation to other whistleblowers. And you've got to remember that there were eight under the Obama administration. She was not the only one. But if you look historically, and we had raised this question over and over again, her sentence was just too long. Even if she was found guilty correctly of the charges, and it wasn't only the Espionage Act. There were a lot of other things that we focused on more than the Espionage Act, because we didn't have a chance under it. We had a chance under some of the other charges. But he said she had served a sentence. She had pleaded guilty, by the way, initially, even before she was tried, to what she believed she was guilty of, several misdemeanors, and the government went ahead and prosecuted her anyway. So she'd already pled guilty to something. She had served her sentence. She'd been an outstanding prisoner. She'd never gotten into any trouble. And he just felt like it was the right thing to do, and I'm glad he did it.
And just one small follow-up on this. This is maybe the right thing to do for Obama, but this is also the president that received a report from the Senate committee confirming that the CIA had a policy of systematic torture. And what was the right thing to do here? What does the Convention Against Torture say? There is an international legal obligation to investigate and prosecute and punish every single act of torture committed by a person under the jurisdiction of the State Department. What does this president say? Oh, let's look forward now. What did Julian Assange say then? What if Chelsea Manning said?
Well, I mean, I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I thought maybe I could use that defense for every case. Let's not look at what he did. Let's just look forward. I completely agree with you.
What if Karachi Chinwadi said that in the Hague?
President Obama did the right thing for Chelsea. Yes, he waited too long. Yes, she served a sentence she should not have served. But I agree, he didn't do the right thing on many other areas, including the Senate committee report.
Who was
waiting
for
Oh, no worries. Hi, guys. I wanted to thank you for this panel. This is very enlightening. My question is, you brought up earlier how you had a false narrative about Julian Assange, and it actually took meeting him. So in regards to that, I do believe we need to protect the press at all accounts, but I do ask, how do you guys counter press or a group of media that chooses to create a narrative that is contradictory to what the actual discussion should be about? Thank you.
Zoom out a little bit and see the big picture. The media, the Fourth Estate, has the role to oversee that the separation of powers functions, right? So we have separation of powers, because we no longer want absolute power since 200 years. But then we also have the press that has to oversee that, and that doesn't function anymore. What you see popping up is WikiLeaks, and people like, and whistleblowers. They take that role because mainstream media no longer does. That's why they exist and why they need to exist.
So any reaction to the role of the media? I think the media has after the latest charges, have actually almost done a 180 degrees shift on their position regarding Julian Assange. Is that also your experience? Because initially he was far more vilified by the media than he has been ever since the last charges, when it really hit home that actually it was not just about him, it was also about us.
Well, we shouldn't forget that the media, the New York Times, the Guardian, Der Spiegel, they all got together and disclosed again what WikiLeaks had disclosed. When Chelsea first went to the New York Times and the Washington Post, they weren't interested, and she went to WikiLeaks. But as soon as WikiLeaks had the documents, all of a sudden, the mainstream press was interested in it. So they decided, well, it was safe after all, because they wanted the information. And now we really can't get any press about Julia, which says something about the mainstream press.
Okay. This gentleman and then you.
One of the amazing things that I've really admired Julian Assange for was the creation of WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks is not Julian Assange. WikiLeaks is basically a publication platform that specializes in a couple of key things that go to the heart of the why don't people leak information issues, right? One is source protection. So the idea with WikiLeaks was that you would have an extremely secure system. All communications are encrypted. There's no possibility that WikiLeaks themselves will know who you are. They're going to guarantee you that they don't know who you are. And no news media can do that. Only WikiLeaks was able to do that, right? At the same time, they guaranteed their sources. They made basically a contract that said, we will publicize this. We will get the media fighting over this story. We will do whatever we can to make sure that the information you're disclosing reaches as many people as possible. So what does that do for whistleblowers? That gives them an incentive to go to WikiLeaks, right? Wow, I've got an extremely important public interest story. If I just give it to The Guardian, maybe I get two articles out of it, and it'll be gone, right? If I give it to WikiLeaks, they're going to shop it to Der Spiegel, they're going to shop it to Le Monde, they're going to shop it to The Times, The Post, they're going to shop it everywhere, and they're going to get all these organizations competing with each other to not be outscooped, right? So, and if they don't, if nobody takes it, WikiLeaks has the option of just publishing it themselves, right? Which gives them incredible credibility and embarrasses the heck out of the media. WikiLeaks is an unbelievably successful concept. And if you just look at the trove of information that they have given to us, which we will be benefiting from for generations to come, you know, like the State Department cables, is in a searchable database, hundreds of thousands of cables, which you can just go, I want to search for Pakistan, I want to search for the head of state of this country, and you find this information there. People are still using this information, right? So WikiLeaks is not about Julian Assange, but he is being relentlessly destroyed because WikiLeaks is so good for us, for the people, for enabling whistleblowers, that's why he's getting this type of punishment. And I'm afraid we, civil society, ordinary people, aren't really going to be able to change that, but we should.
Thank you. I have one more speaker here.
Thank you very much. My mind is in a whirl because I've been studying Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning for about 2 years now. And I love my dear friend Paula for being on fire that way, because I can't see anything changing unless there's a passion about this. I feel there's a horrific silence in the media. That's betrayed true journalism. And I do want to say something about, somebody had asked about the amount of information that whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning were revealing, and how Julian Assange was publishing too much. Well, if anybody was interested, they'd be maybe interviewing Bill Binney, who was the former director of NSA, who was also a whistleblower and is very grateful to Snowden and many whistleblowers. But he said he was the creator of a program that NSA refused to use because it held them accountable. And it was more reasonably priced. So there's all this information that people don't know. They do not want to be held accountable. There is an overreach. Classification is widely used because they do not want us to know what they're doing. And there is an executive order that it is a crime to classify crimes. I'm wondering what is going on with that. So here we have whistleblowers. It takes a lot of courage to come out and expose things. To begin with, you're really risking a lot. And they're exposing all this. And we have war criminals and these crimes being committed and classified. So something is upside down. I'm pretty upset about it. The fact about the systemic nature of all these tropes, there's a very important reason why that is so crucial, because if you might reveal one document, it's very easy for very powerful people to get around it. There's something wonderful about exposing systemic crimes. I can't enough tell you how much this issue affects me. We have a right to know. And one of the things I've loved about Bill Smelser is his July 4th article that appeared in Newsweek. What are we going to do when our right to know is fully sealed? And, you know, I'm looking at the New York Times. I'm wondering why we're not on fire about this. So, yes, I stand with my friend Paula. This is not a small matter. This goes beyond everything. So I'm sorry if I'm all over the place. I'm not a public speaker. I'm not an expert. But I feel like the emotion has to equal what is really at stake here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're doing well as a public speaker.
Yeah. One more, and then final words. Yeah. I was going to give you the floor, actually. Oh, so please go ahead, Nathan. Okay. The co-organizer of this event.
Yeah, I'm the director of the Courage Foundation, Nathan Fuller here. I helped put together this panel, and thank you all. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, the panelists, for being here. I really appreciate it, and to Columbia, of course, for hosting us. I just want to let everyone know, for those who don't, that the Courage Foundation is an international network to support whistleblowers out of other journalistic sources. We've supported Snowden, Manning, Jeremy Hammond, who's also in jail for resisting the grand jury, and now WikiLeaks. And so we host a site for Assange at defend.wikileaks.org, and you can find out a lot more about how to get involved there. And thank you again for coming. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Another question
in the back
of
the
room. Oh, I see. Sorry, I
didn't
you. Sorry. One more question.
Hi, I'm Robin Anderson. I teach music at Fordham University. And I was going to look back at it, look at the bigger picture of the media that a lot of people have raised here. I think that the whistleblowers stand in contrast to a public discourse that has basically been closed down. And what we know is when a country is at war, the domestic issues with freedom of the press are also terribly curtailed. And the United States has been basically at war since the War on Terror, and it's been a constant increase in encroachment upon our democracy. So one of the things that what we know about the media and the military is that the military considers national security to also be what we used to call the hearts and minds of the public. So if information that's going to come out is going to affect their support for war, for example, our support for war, then it can be argued, and is argued within the military, that that is protected because of national security. So my question, I actually do have a question, is we seem to be taking this idea of national security, that it's something that is real. And I would like to propose, from what so many of the people have said about taking away our rights and our democratic rights, is that when our country is at war, the nature of that war is ultimately secret, because they can only carry it out if they convince us that it's so important that they have to do it because they're going over and killing people. So we have to be in the dark constantly that this is not about international relations, it's not about resources, it's not about anything like that. So
is there a legal way that we can try to make those kinds of arguments and challenge the very notion of national security, because it seems like that may be the only avenue to provide openings with all parts of the press. Because what we found now is that the major news media in our country are highly aligned with the military in what we call the
question. Sandy, I'll start with you.
Oh, you can answer another question.
Does anybody else want to?
I just have one thought on that, and that's that many people have been arguing that in an Espionage Act prosecution, you should be able to show that no harm to the national security resulted from a particular disclosure. And courts, including in Chelsea Manning's case, have considered that evidence irrelevant under the Espionage Act as it's currently written. And the government has repeatedly argued that it doesn't matter whether or not there actually resulted any harm to the national security. The question under the statute is whether or not there could have been any harm to national security. So pushing back on that and insisting that courts take into account whether at the end of the day the government can actually point to any national security harms in a particular prosecution, I think is incredibly important and bound up in the public interest events that we've been discussing this evening.
Well, let me just add that the concept of national security is a very fluid concept. That's part of the problem. It's broader than just classified evidence. But exactly what it is always a little unclear. You know, I can give one quick example. There were five men who were members of the Taliban who were in Guantanamo. They were politicians. They were not soldiers. But we were told they had to stay there forever because of national security. But then when it was important to make a trade, they were released, and the next day it was okay, and national security would not be harmed by releasing these particular five people. So I use that as an example because it is whatever is in the minds of the government, and it becomes very difficult to defend against. And it always will be difficult to defend against the concept of national security, but we need to know how fluid a concept it is.
Okay, I'll take my cue from that. Back to the Schwane principles. So I'm guilty as charged of being a lawyer, and I'm actually pretty passionate about the law and about justice. But my method is the law. We sat around and we discussed what is national security and what information can legitimately be withheld, and we did come up with some narrow definitions here based upon international standards and where we see the law to be evolving. But importantly, we also set forth categories of information that may never be withheld. And that includes information about war crimes and grave human rights violations, places of detention, methods of surveillance, and laws and policies. And again, we haven't been challenged on those statements. Back to the point about the press doesn't need a public interest defense, absolutely, and I hope I didn't suggest otherwise. So in the principles also, the press should not be punished at all for disclosing classified information. We have here a principle based on international law. A person who was not a public servant may not be sanctioned for the receipt, possession, or disclosure to the public of classified information. And then we went a step further to where we hope the law is evolving. A person who is not a public servant may not be subject to charges for conspiracy or other crimes based on the fact of having sought and obtained the information. That's where we hope things are going, and we're looking, we look to litigate in forums where we hope we can start to push these principles.
And Sandy, just a quick question. I mean, the environment we live in at the moment is not very conducive, I presume, to governments progressively adopting this kind of standard. I mean, in my work, all I can see is national security issues, counterterrorism creeping in every single aspect of social, political, humanitarian life, criminalization of humanitarian assistance because of national security or counterterrorism. So are the prospect of good defense and really fighting back contextual, I mean, driven by our environment at the moment and making it very difficult to be successful?
Well, absolutely, it's a challenge. I'd say there's possibilities for success in countries where there's a jury system. There are very few of countries that still have jury systems. I think that we, as lawyers, need to be thinking more about the legislature as a defense of rights. And impressive in Europe that there are legislators who see the problems of extraordinary rendition and of a US-UK power access that's not constrained. So maybe the legislature is an institution that provides some hope in some places.
You don't want me to start to sing, you will be ill treatment. Now, two things. I mean, one thing that intrigued me when you mentioned Chelsea Manning being detained now, and it said that she holds the key to jail because if she cooperates, she can get out. Well, that's what was said about Julian Assange. He can leave the embassy at any time. That's what the British mission said yesterday when in the General Assembly when I mentioned this case and criticized the UK and responded, well, he could have left at any time. Well, what if you tell a political refugee, well, you can go home any time? That's the concept of torture. You can stop torture any time. Just cooperate, just confess, just say what we want to say. That's the same logic, there's no difference. So this is, it sounds seductive, but it is, that's the spirit of torture. If you detain someone indefinitely until you break them, that's torture. I shouldn't do all of that. Concluding remarks though, how do you distinguish democracies from tyrannies? It's not about, you know, that in tyrannies you have bad people in power and in democracies you have good people in power. No, it's a systemic distinction. In tyranny, tyrannies allow for unchecked power, while democracies don't. They insist on the rule of law and the separation of power. If democracies get on the slippery slope of striving to, based on whatever arguments, national security, crisis, war, you know, and so on, they start to kind of shrink that space prevent separation of power and oversight. And then you see the mainstream media playing the game and so on, and no longer controlling the government and the three branches of government. If government no longer reacts to Parliament, Congress, concluding that it has been tortured, they don't prosecute, the judiciary doesn't prosecute anymore. By the way, Britain just now copy-pasted that. This summer, Boris Johnson's first act in government, Banish Buchanan, was to scrap a judicial inquiry into the British involvement in the CIA rendition and torture program, and the judicial inquiry that the government had promised for years. So now they're doing the same. And if when that happens, democracies get on the slippery slope towards tyranny. That's where we're heading. We're not there yet, but that's where we're heading. And it's a slippery slope. There is no right line, there's no natural stop here. So we need to be aware of the big picture of what's going on. Julian Assange is important as an individual. Chelsea Manning is important as an individual. All the others are. But what this really is about is the elephant in the room. And the only way you miss an elephant, can miss an elephant in a room, is when you have a bright spotlight pointing at you, and behind the spotlight is the elephant. So whenever you look in the spotlight, you can't see them. That's why they put the spotlight on all these people, and now we're discussing, you know, public interest defense and all these things. It's important. But the elephant is in the other corner. And that's, there is no oversight. There's, even when we have reports and evidence for war crimes, there is no consequence. There is impunity. That's the big scandal here. Here, in the UK, in all other countries as well, it's not about the US fashion. The US is a great country. But this is not the way we should be heading.
To all of you, you've stayed all the way to the end, and I'm sure the panelists will appreciate a few more interactions if so you wish, and continue the discussion. I want to thank all of you very much for sharing your expertise and views, and thank you to Niels as well for the fantastic work you've been doing over the last 10 months defending Julian Assange, but in a way that your mandate was not necessarily leading you to that naturally. And I know this has been very tough, and I'm very grateful to you for doing that and giving an example to all of the special procedures. So thank you very much. Thank you very much to everybody.